Morning, September 16. Carrying on still with the study of God's character, I'd like to open this session by referring you now to the first chapter of the book of Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 1 to 3. This, of course, is a declaration in regard to Jesus Christ as the Father, the Son of the Father. It says in verse 1, God who at sundry times and in divers manners, but in time, spake in time past unto the fathers by the prophets, hath in these last days spoken unto us by his Son, whom he hath appointed heir of all things, by whom also he made the worlds, who being the brightness of his glory and the express image of his person, and upholding all things by the word of his power, when he had by himself purged our sins, sat down on the right hand of the majesty on high. Now the essential point I wish to direct your attention to in this verse is the fact that first of all, God through Jesus Christ made the worlds. But God did not, or Christ did not then, as the Creator, launch those worlds into space to carry on their way like a gigantic piece of wound up clockwork mechanism. But moment by moment, continuously, those worlds are held in their place by the same creative energy that brought them into existence in the first case. As verse 3 says, and upholding all things by the word of his power. In the book Education, page 132, this verse is quoted, and it goes on to say then, the Apostle Paul, writing by the Holy Spirit, declares of Christ that all things have been created through him and unto him, and he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. Colossians 1, 16 and 17, revised version. In the regular version that we use so much, the King James Version, it simply reads, and by him, or in him, all things consist. But the word consist, of course, does mean to hold together. The hand that sustains the world in space, the hand that holds in their orderly arrangement and tireless activity all things throughout the universe of God, is the hand that was nailed to the cross for us. The essential point I wish you to observe here is this, that God did not simply make these worlds and then turn them loose to go in their ordered courses throughout the universe, that momentarily the hand of God is there to uphold and sustain those worlds in their ordered courses. Now take this word to uphold. If you're upholding something and then take your hands away, what's going to happen? It's going to fall. Because things don't fall out in space because there's no up and no down, is there? Everything's up or down, whichever way you want to look at it, I suppose, but it's all relative. But the same thought nonetheless is present there, because if moment by moment is being sustained by the power of God, then the moment the power of God is removed, then at that moment things are going to go really to pieces. And my mind goes forward at this moment to time in the very near future when the restraining presence of God is going to be removed from both the devil and from nature. And I am quite impressed by the picture painted here in the book Great Controversy, where it talks about the coming of the fifth plague. It said, with shouts of triumph, jeering and imprecation, throngs of evil men are about to rush upon their prey, when lo, a dense blackness, deeper than the darkness of the night, falls upon the earth. This is page 635 and 636 in Great Controversy. Now we know, of course, that at this moment the angry multitudes are arrested. And then Sister White says, it is at midnight that God manifests his power for the deliverance of his people. Let me draw a picture here on the blackboard now. Here is the earth. Here at this point on the face of the earth stands a company of God's people. To them it's midnight. So at that point of time, where is the sun? It's over here on the other side, isn't it? Well, it should be at midnight. But the next sentence says, the sun appears, shining in its strength. Signs and wonders follow in quick succession. The wicked look with terror and amazement upon the scene, while the righteous behold with solemn joy the tokens of their deliverance. Everything in nature seems turned out of its course. The stream ceased to flow. Dark heavy clouds come up and clash against each other. In the midst of the angry heavens is one clear space of indescribable glory, whence comes the voice of God like the sound of many waters, saying, "It is done." And then comes that stupendous earthquake that doesn't just simply shake Los Angeles, or perhaps Japan, but shakes the entire world from side to side. A read where it says that here, "The whole earth heaves and swells like the waves of the sea. Its surface is breaking up. Its very foundations seem to be giving away. Mountain chains are sinking. Inhabited islands disappear. The seaports that have become like Sodom for wickedness are swallowed up by the angry waters." Now we are having placed before us here a picture of nature when the sustaining hand of God has been removed. The sun suddenly around on the bottom side of the earth. How'd it get there? I don't suppose the sun travelled 180 million miles and that's your atomic history. Earth did a complete back turn or something like that. We don't know exactly what's going to happen. There's certainly going to be a fearful convulsion of nature. Streams cease to flow. The whole world, just like the waves of the sea, great mountain chains sinking, whole islands disappearing beneath the waters of the sea. It's going to be rather a terrifying time, isn't it? Especially for those who don't have the sustaining spirit of God to keep them in that time. Now we don't realize for one moment how much we depend upon God moment by moment, not only to protect us from the malice of Satan, that's one thing, and a very, very important thing too, but just as importantly, if not more importantly, there is the fact that nature itself needs the continual presence of God to keep it under control. We read the other day how that as the Spirit of God is withdrawn from this earth, Satan is allowed to have more and more control over the elements. And he uses these elements to his own benefits, or his own purpose, by bringing earthquakes, tidal waves, and all these great convulsions. But I believe that the convulsions we read about down to the 5th and 6th and 7th plagues, in this book, Great Controversy, as we read them just a few moments ago, is far more than Satan at work. Rather, we have here the picture of what will take place when God's sustaining, upholding, and controlling power is removed from nature down there in the end of time. Now, naturally, of course, God will not entirely remove his power at that time because there are too many of his people down here upon this earth, and for their sakes, there will still be a certain measure of control over the elements. And for their sakes, of course, there'll be a wall of protection around them, each one individually. Now, coming back again to Great Controversy 5:3-4, I read here in regard to Satan's activities, however, where it says, "God is love, and all that he created was pure, holy, and lovely, until sin was brought in by the first great rebel. Satan himself is the enemy who tempts man to sin, and then destroys him if he can. And when he has made sure of his victim, then he exults in the ruin he has wrought. If permitted, he would sweep the entire race into his net. Were it not for the interposition of divine power, not one son or daughter of Adam would escape." So every moment of every day of our lives, there hangs over us the threat of double destruction. Destruction at Satan's hands, and destruction at the hands of an unleashed nature. And only because God in both of these spheres holds back the fearful winds of strife do we find ourselves able to continue our existence moment by moment and day by day. Now we have learned from our study over the past 2 or 3 days that God's long-suffering patience and love enables him to maintain that wall of protection around us until a certain point of time is reached. And what is that point of time? The point of time when men come to a final decision to have no more to do with God. The point of time when every undecided person has made their decision the one way or the other. When that time comes, then God simply acknowledges their wish and their request, and he leaves them to reap that which they themselves have sown. Now let's go back to the flood and consider for a moment
a tremendous energy required to maintain the fire that was the moon and the fire that was the sun.
Have you ever stopped to think about the sun? Scientists have evolved all kinds of theories about how the sun is able to continue burning week after week, month after month, year after year, century after century, millennium after millennium, and never go any dimmer. Well now, how does this happen? Is there a gigantic pipeline that's pouring fuel into it from somewhere? There isn't, is there? But we all know down upon this earth, in the principle of combustion, if you want a fire to burn, you must fuel it. Isn't that true? You must fuel it. And when you think of the fantastic amount of combustion and heat energy being expended up there in the sun, could that sun possibly have in itself a sufficient reservoir of fuel to burn so far for 6,000 years almost and not go any dimmer? Impossible. Look at the moon up there today. It was once a ball of fire, but it is not today a great ball of fuel. It's just a ball of stone and dirt like the earth is down here. So the how, according to scriptures then, is the sun and the moon, or are the sun and the moon able to maintain their glowing, well, the moon back there, of course, I'm referring to, but the sun today, how is the sun able to go on burning at the same heat and not go out? What's the only possible answer? God keeps sustaining it directly. And when the sun back there was seven times hotter than it is now, it needed just that much more of God's power to keep it burning day after day and shedding its great heat down here upon this earth, and the moon likewise. But there upon this earth, a situation was developing as the centuries rolled by, a situation in which men became more and more wicked and more careless and disrespectful of God. They did this because they had made the decision not to serve God but to serve self. Now, as I said yesterday or the day before, God had the perfect right to call upon them to come to a decision. And when God saw that the wickedness in the world was very great and was growing worse and worse and worse, then God said, I must do something about this. I must come down and bring this situation to an end. And he did. But how did he bring that situation to an end? He brought that situation down by calling a messenger. What was his name? Right, his name was Noah. And God called upon that man to preach the gospel. And the preaching of the gospel was the calling of men to a decision, the one way or the other. And as for 120 years, Noah preached that decision. The more men upon the earth in those days heard that preaching, the more they became confirmed in their rebellions and defiance of God, until they reached that place where, as a direct result of that preaching, they passed the point of no return, and as a direct result of that preaching, ask God to leave them alone completely. Now, I want you to recognize the fact that it was the preaching of Noah that brought the world to that state of affairs. Isn't that right? And when they came to that state of affairs, there was no way of saving them from destruction unless God should at that point take away their right to choose. But if God, to save them from destruction then, or to take away their right to choose then why give them the right to choose in the first case? Would that be logical? It wouldn't, would it? Did you follow me? Maybe I should explain very carefully to you what is meant when we say that in order to save them at this point, God would have had to take away their right to choose. Their right to choose at that point was manifest by them in their wish, very clearly expressed, that God should leave them. In order to honor and respect that choice, what did God have to do? He had to withdraw. When God withdrew, then of course there went with him that sustaining power that kept all these forces of nature in their orderly course. And of course the moon very obviously went out as a result. We know today the moon was once a self-luminous body because the Bible tells us so. The Bible tells us the moon was once as bright as the sun, and we know to be that, it had to be self-luminous. The moon went out. When did it go out? Very obviously, at the time of the flood.
And as God's sustaining presence was further withdrawn, the sun began to go down and down and down until it reached a point where it was only 1/7 of its former brightness.
And was then at the same level as it is today. Now, God knew
that when he began to depart from the earth in response to the request of man, God knew that this was going to be the result.
To prevent that result from taking place, God would have had to have said to those people upon this earth, I'm sorry about your request. I am not prepared to grant you the freedom of its execution. I am staying whether you like it or not. Now, is that the way of God? It's not the way of God, is it? God will not remain, and he cannot remain where his presence is not desired. Not at all. You know, it distresses me no end sometimes when I see some very, very well-meaning missionary workers going and meeting with someone, and they begin to talk to a person about the gospel, and the person obviously doesn't want to listen. But to be polite, he does listen. But he reveals enough of his disinterest to show he doesn't want to listen. But the missionary worker presses him with the arguments, and the more the man appears to be disinterested, the more he presses upon him the arguments of the gospel. Is that God's way? No, it's not God's way. We should be very sensitive to the responsiveness of a person. If he doesn't want to hear it, then under no circumstances should we attempt to go on making him hear what he doesn't want to hear. And there's nothing which I find a more embarrassing situation than when some well-meaning person, maybe a parent or a friend, organizes another person to come and hear a study which the other person obviously doesn't want to hear. And I'm called upon to give a study to a person who doesn't want to hear it. And sometimes the circumstances make it very difficult to evade doing what you know is not a divine principle anyway. And so it was then
that in order for God to save those people then from the flood, he would have had to deprive them of the freedom which he gave them in the first place. Therefore, if to save them here, he must take away their freedom, then why give them that freedom in the first place? God doesn't work that way. God is absolutely just. And when those people have the right to make that choice, then God in justice did not take away that right from them, but led them to that right, even though God knew what the consequences of their choice was going to be.
Now let's face the fact today that we must learn this same lesson. You may, for instance, see a child in the care of unbelieving parents, and that child is being raised as an ungodly child. Maybe he is being deprived of many of life's necessities and so forth. And we feel sometimes that the end justifies the means, yes, and we feel we should go in and literally take that child away from the people who have control of that child. But if that child is there as the rightful child of a parent, then no matter what the end result may be, no matter how much that child may suffer, we must not intervene into an area that is the right of another person. We must not. We may go and counsel, we may go and make offers, but we must not, under any circumstances, take an action which is going to interfere with the rights of another person. Because God doesn't do that, no matter what the cost may be. You see the point? There, if God had intervened in the rights of those people, he could have saved them from that destruction. But he would not do it because he had given them the right to choose, and when they exercised that right to choose, God respected that right, no matter what the cost might be to God personally or to those people in turn. And so God withdrew his presence at their request. Now, mark this point, it was at their request. God didn't want to, any more than God had any desire to withdraw from the city of Jerusalem. God does not desire to see his fair creation destroyed, nor does he exult in the destruction of the wicked. But he must respect the rights of those individuals.
Now what's going to happen when we suddenly find that the amount of heat energy being directed towards this atmosphere around the earth is reduced from 8 down to 1? 1/8 of the heat.
Yes.
The sun went right out, I mean the moon went right out, and the sun came down to 1/7. So suddenly 1/8 of the previous heat is now being directed toward this cloud mantle around the earth.
Now what's going to happen first of all? Before condensation, that will be the second thing. What's the first thing? A cooling, a tremendous chilling of the atmosphere. And you know that when suspended cloud or vapor or water, as the case may be, is chilled, what will it at once begin to do? It'll begin to rain or snow, as the case may be. And then all that water, which before it separated from the earth had made a complete plug around the earth, all that water now returns upon the earth, and what do we have? The flood. Now, it didn't cover Mount Everest because Mount Everest didn't exist back in those days. It would have been a flood, wouldn't it, if it had gone 30,000 feet above the earth's surface all around. I really have to ask, where's that water gone since, if we had that much? Before the flood, the earth was vastly different from what it is today. There were no great Rocky Mountain chains, no great ocean depths as we now have them, and no great frozen masses of water up there at the north and the south pole. And therefore, it was not as difficult a thing to flood the earth then as it would be to flood the earth today. In addition, of course, to the water coming down from above, the Bible says the fountains of the great deep were broken up, and so the earth rent open, and forth from beneath the surface, there gushed out gigantic torrents of water, which in a very, very short time reduced the earth to a state of absolute desolation and destruction. In our study of the fall of Jerusalem, we recognize there that far from God standing as an executioner against those sinners, far from him having directly sent the Romans under his personal command to wipe out the Jews and destroy their city, I shouldn't use the word wipe out, but to wipe out many of them and take the rest captive, far from God doing that, God had labored most earnestly to save that city from destruction. But in the very effort of God to save them from destruction, he had brought them to destruction. Now this is an important principle which I hope you can really understand. God hardened Pharaoh's heart how? By trying to soften it. He destroyed Jerusalem how? By trying to save it. And he destroyed the earth back there how? By trying to save it. And when, as a result of the preaching of Noah, the earth came to that point of total abandonment of God, a situation arose then when God, far from actually sending the flood as a direct outpouring of his power, as a personal act, I mean, of course, because it was the outpouring of his power anyway, all powers of God, and that was a work of fearfully destructive power, far from God doing that, God was not able to save that world from destruction without reversing his previous stand. It was sin itself that destroyed the earth back there. Satan didn't do it. We can't say for one moment that Satan did it as he did it there in the city of Jerusalem. It was sin itself which brought about that destruction. Now when the world was destroyed by the flood, you come to Matthew 24 now for a moment, you find that Jesus said, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the coming of the Son of Man. Let's turn to those well-known scriptures here to read this thought again, verse 36, 7 and on. Matthew 24, beginning at verse 36. But of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days of before the flood they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until a day that Noah entered into the ark, and knew not until the flood came and took them all away, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. Now, so far, I want now to begin to make some comparisons, if we can, between each of these great events in the past. First of all, there was the flood. And this was the first really great destructive work which has ever appeared upon the face of the earth in its entire history. So let's place the flood here at this side of the board.
In the middle, we'll put the words, the fall of Jerusalem. Then we'll pass on to the seven last plagues. And finally, to the very end, when there will be the total annihilation of the wicked and the purifying of the earth with fire.
We read from Great Controversy 36 that God does not stand toward the sinner as an executioner of the sentence against transgression, but he leaves the rejecters of his mercy to themselves to reap that which they have sown. Now let me ask you the question, I want you to really answer this. Have we seen that in the fall of Jerusalem, that was the way God worked there? That was clear, wasn't it? We have the clear authority of the book Great Controversy to tell us that.
Now come back to the flood, and as we investigate the principles there, do we find that after the flood, God did not then stand as an executioner toward the sinner, but he left the rejecters of his mercy to reap that which they themselves had sown?
Is that likewise true there? It was, wasn't it?
Now we come on to the seven last plagues.
And our authority for believing it'll be the same there is found again in this book, Great Controversy. I'll read you the statement again where it says on page 22 of the Great Controversy, we find that these words are spoken. Christ saw in Jerusalem a symbol of the world hardened in unbelief and rebellion, and hastening on to meet the retributive judgments of God. Now I go across to page 37, where we find the same thought repeated in perhaps even clearer terms. It says, it begins on page 36, the Saviour's prophecy concerning the visitation of judgments upon Jerusalem is to have another fulfillment, of which that terrible desolation was but a faint shadow. In the fate of the chosen city, we may behold the doom of a world that has rejected God's mercy and trampled upon his city. Now what is this telling us?
We see in the fall of Jerusalem, we see the doom of that city.
And what does the word doom mean?
Destiny.
It's destiny, yes. Is somebody else another word perhaps? It's destruction, it's fate. Now, does not the word doom contain in itself the meaning of the way in which the destruction comes? Right? The word contains the idea of the way in which the destruction comes.
Now, if then the way in which destruction fell upon Jerusalem is a picture of the way in which things will happen at the very end, then how will the plagues come? As an executionary act upon God's part?
Or will this once again be God's leaving the sinners to reap that which they have sown? Inasmuch as God is the same yesterday, today and forever, it must be the leaving by God of the sinners to reap that which they have sown. Now I turn back here to page 614 in the book Great Controversy. And here it says, when he leaves the sanctuary, darkness covers the inhabitants of the earth. In that fearful time, the righteous must live in the sight of a holy God without an intercessor. Page 614. The restraint which has been upon the wicked is removed, and Satan has entire control of the finally impenitent. God's long-suffering has ended. The world has rejected his mercy, despised his love, and trampled upon his law. The wicked have passed the boundary of their probation. The Spirit of God, persistently resisted, has been at last withdrawn. Now, notice how with regular consistency we find this thought of withdrawal present in each of these great stories. Isn't that true? With regular consistency. Unsheltered by divine grace, they have no protection from the wicked one. Satan will then plunge the inhabitants of the earth into one great final trouble. As the angels of God cease to hold in check all the fierce winds of human passion, all the elements of strife will be let loose. The whole world will be involved in ruin more terrible than that which came upon Jerusalem of old. But while the ruin is more terrible, it will be the same. It will come in the same way, exactly as in the other instances. Now the next paragraph, I'll read at the moment, and I'm going to ask you to wait till we come to this later, because I'm sure someone will put the question to me, so I'll beat you to it by putting the question back to you. A single angel destroyed all the firstborn of the Egyptians and filled the land with mourning. When David offended against God by numbering the people, one angel caused that terrible destruction by which his sin was punished. The same destructive power exercised by a holy angel than God commands will be exercised by evil angels than he permits. There are forces now ready and only waiting the divine permission to spread desolation everywhere. And that's one of those hard statements, isn't it? Because it seems to say, it seems to speak in the exact contradiction to all we've said so far in the series. But I have some other statements which I'll read to you later. I don't want to get off my theme at the moment, which will make very, very clear to you that when an angel destroys, he does not destroy as man destroys. Because an angel does things how? God's way. And God's ways are not man's ways. So just rest on that for a moment and be patient a little while. And probably in our next session, when we come to this afternoon, we'll take up this matter of the destroying angels. But I want now to deal with the great destructions of all time, and we're finding a remarkable consistency between God's dealings at the flood, at the fall of Jerusalem, and at the plague. And I should place in here, of course, between the fall of Jerusalem, or the flood and the fall of Jerusalem, the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Because Sodom and Gomorrah is also a type, is it not, of the destruction down at the last days. And we're not told very much about the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, excepting once again the language is so similar to that of the flood and to Matthew 22. Let's come back with me now to the book of Genesis, and we'll just read something of the story as outlined here in the experience of Abraham. I'd like to notice some things in the book Patriarchs and Prophets in respect to the burning of those two cities out there on the plain. The story is in Genesis 19, 19th chapter of the book of Genesis. We know, of course, let's begin with verse 19, or maybe chapter 9. Maybe go back to verse chapter 18 and read something of the conversation between God and Abraham before the angels and Christ with the angels went down to the actual city. And verse 16 of chapter 18, we find the story begins. And the men rose up from thence and looked towards Sodom, and Abraham went with them to bring them on the way. And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham the thing which I do? That thing which I do. And that the wording, that thing which I do. Seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgments, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he has spoken of him. And the Lord said, because the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grievous, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the cry of it, which has come unto me, and if not, I will know. The men turned their faces from thence and went towards Sodom, but Abraham stood yet before the Lord. Now Abraham knew perfectly well that when God went down there, he'd find cities beyond redemption, didn't he? He knew that they were going to be destroyed. Verse 23, and Abraham drew near and said, wilt thou also destroy the righteous with the wicked? Peradventure there be 50 righteous within the city. Wilt thou also destroy and not spare the place for the 50 righteous that are therein? That be far from thee to do after this manner, to slay the righteous with the wicked. And that the righteous should be as the wicked, that be far from thee, shall not the judge of all the earth do right? Now yesterday we had a study in which we showed how that if God was to destroy, he would be very just, and he would never punish the innocent with the guilty. We could very well have used the scripture, couldn't we, to help support that principle, because Abraham understood that God is righteous. God is different from sin, and that while sin does destroy the innocent with the guilty, that is far from God to do that. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right? And the Lord said, If I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then will I spare all the place for their sakes. Now I won't take time to read the continuing discussion between Abraham as he reduced the numbers down and down, and the Lord kept assuring him that he would not destroy if he found this certain minimum number of people in the city. Now come to verse 12 of chapter 19. The story now has brought us forward to when Lot is entertaining these messengers who have come to his door. In verse 12, these messengers announce the purpose of their visit. And the men said unto Lot, Hast thou here any besides son-in-law and thy sons and thy daughters? And whatsoever thou hast in the city, bring them out of this place. For we will destroy this place. Because the cry of them is waxen great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord hath sent us to destroy it. Now, I think we've read enough to get the strong language that is used here. But let me ask you this question. Is there any difference between the wording here in Genesis 19 and the wording back there in Genesis chapter 6? Any difference? In Genesis 6, the Lord said, I will destroy the earth. In Genesis 19, they say, I will destroy this city. In Matthew 22, what does God say? I will destroy this city and destroy those murderers. Now, can you detect any difference in the language? There's none, is there? In every place it reads the same. In every place God says what he will do. And therefore, as surely as we know what God did at Jerusalem, and what God did back at the flood, and what God will do in the seven last plagues, then just so surely can we know what God did back there at Sodom and Gomorrah. It has to be the same, because God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Now some folks say to me, but why is the Bible written that way? Why is it written differently? For the very, very simple reason that the problem lies with us. The problem lies in the fact that we always tend to think of God's ways and our ways being the same. Down on this earth, we know about destroyers. We know that in time of war, men go out to destroy. We know how men destroy. We know all about this by experience, by observation. We've even done some destroying ourselves. Maybe we've destroyed a plant. Maybe we've killed an animal or something like that. And we're familiar with one kind of way of destroying. And we're not familiar with the other kind of way of destroying. And so therefore, we tend to think of this word destroy only in the terms of human experience and human activity. And that's where our mistake comes in, doesn't it? We have to think and remember at all times that God's ways are not our ways, neither are his thoughts our thoughts. God does destroy, and therefore the Bible has to say that God destroys. But remember this, his way of destroying is to try and save. Is it in the interest and purpose of God to destroy sin? Certainly it is. And sinners? Certainly it is. It is the purpose of God to once again bring about that situation where only righteousness and peace shall occupy the whole earth. And so God doesn't sit back and do nothing. God does intervene in the human scene. God does come down and do something. He does that which will bring about these destructions, because in so doing, he is being merciful and just even to those who are being destroyed. But remember, his way of destroying is to do every single thing he can possibly do to save them from that destruction. And so it was there in the cities on the plain. Now the record says, of course, that fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them or destroyed them. We do not know the exact nature of that fire. It could have been a vast volcanic eruption. Today, the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah have disappeared so completely as a result of that destruction that they cannot even be found. No one today even knows where they were. They have disappeared off the face of the earth. Supposing it was a volcanic eruption which devoured those cities, and that is quite possible, then up until the time of their destruction, God was by his mighty power holding back the impending doom, keeping it under control, until there came a point of time when, because of the wish of the people, he could hold that destruction back no longer. He moved his protecting presence, as he did there at Jerusalem, as back at the flood, and what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah. They were obliterated from the face of the earth, as completely as men will be down here at the very end of time. In every one of these instances, we find that God's dealings with men are ever the same. Now, time is exhausted for this period, but later we'll go on to study briefly the scene down there at the end of the 1,000 years, the march against the city, and what God does down there at that point of time, and how, when sin will finally have destroyed itself and obliterated itself, then the angels will see then what they would not have seen had Satan been left to be destroyed by his own sins back there in the beginning. And God will then be forever vindicated. Remember this thought in closing, that the very reason as to why God allowed the great controversy to continue was to show that when Satan came to his end, it would not be under God's hand, but as a result of his own course of action. Therefore, how must Satan eventually die? He must eventually die.